The Rebel Capitalist Show, Episode 20.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to bring someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show that we've had on before. He's an awesome guest. His name is Chris Irons, and he is with the very popular podcast, Quote the Raven. Chris, welcome back to the show.
Thanks a lot, George, and congratulations on the enormity of the success of your YouTube channel, which, by the way, has every time I refresh the page, you get like another 5,000 subscribers on YouTube, which is just awesome because we need your perspective so badly. The world needs it badly. And so I'm very encouraged to see that. And I appreciate you having me back on.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate the kind words. And it's definitely been a wild ride. I'm enjoying it. But you texted me yesterday on Twitter because you wanted to talk about Zero Hedge specifically. So yeah. I want to dive into that. For those of the viewers and the people maybe listening to this on my audio or podcast feed and who don't know, last Friday or Saturday morning is when my Twitter blew up. Twitter banned Zero Hedge. And I actually watched your response to Jack at Twitter, that live deal that you did, that like 14-minute video. And if you want to start by just giving us a summary of that, that was a really, really awesome video. And I think you kind of, you just described the whole situation very well.
Yes. Yeah, so for people that don't know, and people that don't know like what Zero Hedge is, even some people, Zero Hedge is pretty much like a libertarian financial website. You know, they delve into politics sometimes. I gotta take this off here. They delve into politics sometimes, but the majority of the content on the site is finance. And they are, as many libertarians are, proponents of the Austrian School of Economics, and they're very critical of Fed policy and monetary policy. And they're pretty much skeptics of everything, which is fantastic. If you're a skeptic, it's a wonderful site to read. I agree with some things on that site. I disagree with other things on it. But coming from the world of finance, I feel like the ethos of the site matches a lot of the same skepticism that I have about monetary policy and central banking that me and you talked about on the last podcast that we did, where I got worked up and started sweating and screaming and cursing. the other thing that Zero Hedge did, they would offer commentary on like politics. I mean, the site is still up. They're just not on Twitter anymore. So you can go to zerohedge.com and check out the site. But the other thing that they, and there's rumors and musings actually that they're doing better now that Twitter banned them.
I don't doubt it.
Yeah, it's become a story. And I've heard from people that that are close to the site that their traffic has actually increased with this social media ban. And we'll talk about that in a second. But you know, they delve into some political content. They toe the line, I think, and try to explore a lot of things that many people would consider to be conspiratorial. Yet, as their one of their pages on their site, their like manifesto on their site says, you know, oftentimes a lot of the conspiracy theories become conspiracy fact. And, you know, your viewers and certainly the people that follow me, we understand that, you know, not every conspiracy theory is truthful and not every conspiracy theory is right. But to say that over the course of history, none of them have ever proven to be true is complete bullshit. I mean, and everybody knows that. So a lot of things that kind of over time are revealed as the truth were at one point conspiratorial sounding in nature, right? So the other thing that the site does, basically it's a news aggregator, right? So they aggregate a lot of news from like Wall Street Journal and Bloomberg and Reuters. And, you know, I read like probably 3 to 4 articles on there every day because the content that they select is very good. And it's especially good if you're from the Austrian school, because that is the lens with which they look at everything. So they are critical of, you know, these ridiculous nonsense Keynesian theories that are, you know, being advocated for nowadays. They're critical of modern monetary theory. They're critical of taking on too much debt. They're critical of using spending as a way to gauge the economy instead of savings. So a lot of that makes sense for me personally, and probably for matches the ideologue of a lot of your viewers as well.
Yeah, but Chris, I just want to interject really quick, but they're also extremely critical of Trump. So a lot of people just assume that, you know, they read some of their content. Oh, this is just some right wing, you know, site, or and they don't understand that it's there. If you keep reading, they're not only critical of the left, but they're very critical of the right. I think Mark Spiegel, who's a great guest that you have on all the time, said it very well, and that they're not pro Trump, they're anti everything. And I think that's a good way to sum it up.
So, yeah, we'll talk about that in a second, because I want to talk about what happened and what led to the Twitter suspension. What I'll just say also, too, is that their Twitter feed, not only I think their Twitter feed automatedly generated, like when they would post a new article, it would blast out the article on Twitter so that people could see something new had been published on the site. But in between that, you can tell that somebody's on there providing commentary. And oftentimes, as news is breaking during the day, I know a lot of traders that had 670,000 followers. A lot of people followed it because they would often take the news feed off the Bloomberg terminal and post it, as I do, as many other traders do on Twitter, oftentimes with their own commentary. So, you know, you'll see a news item, and then there'll be some clever quip underneath it, you know, 2 seconds worth of their editorialization. And they also dove relatively deep into the markets. It wasn't a pump and dump newsletter. It was guys that were looking at, you know, credit spreads and, CDOs and the complexities of those things. And they look at private equity, and they look at the leveraged loan market, and they look at subprime autos. So it's not just guys making, you know, general commentary in the market. Whoever is posting on their Twitter is clearly an expert with a fluency in finance in the markets that has over the years been a learning experience for me reading the thing, because every once in a while I read something on their Twitter and I have to Google it. Like, all right, well, what is this? And I got to learn about what it is. And so for me and people of all varying degrees of financial literacy on FinTwit, which is the financial Twitter community, it was a great resource for no nonsense, no bullshit information that a lot of people, if you don't pay $25,000 a year for a Bloomberg terminal, or $25,000 a month or whatever it is, it's fucking expensive, that's the point. If you don't pay for that, you know, this was a great feed to follow to get news up to date. So anyways, that is a majority of what they provided. Now, what happened leading to their suspension from Twitter was BuzzFeed had written an article about them where BuzzFeed identified the website as, in the headline of their article, as a pro-Trump blog just doxed a Chinese scientist in Wuhan, basically. It was something like that. That was the title of their article. So first and foremost, to identify the blog as a pro-Trump blog is a error. The blog, I think, was started sometime around the financial crisis. It was the impetus for starting it was to be critical of the way the financial crisis was being handled, I think. And this is all, obviously, I'm not speaking for Zero Hedge. I'm just giving you what I know just from reading it. But the impetus, I think, for starting it was that they were being critical of the way that the financial crisis was being handled, and just critical of central banking and monetary policy in general. So to come out and call it a pro-Trump blog and identify it as such, as if it just came around in fucking 2016 and it's only been supporting Donald Trump and that's the main ethos of the site, is horribly incorrect. And as you just pointed out, one of the things that they have often been critical about with Trump is the way that he cozies up to Jerome Powell. So not unlike my friend Peter Schiff and myself on my podcast, you know, we are often critical of Trump because of the fact that Trump ran on the policy that we were in a big fat bubble. Yellen had created a bubble and he was going to fix it before it got out of hand. And then as soon as he got into office, the opposite happened. He you know, hit that button like on your futures trader where you want to reverse your position. So if you're short something, you automatically cover it and then you buy the same position, or vice versa. He hit the fucking reverse button. And all of a sudden, it was blue skies ahead, let's lower rates, let's print money. As long as the stock market's going up, I'm going to use that as my scorecard, right? So for people that don't read the content, obviously, like this BuzzFeed reporter who was wholly incorrect, and their editing staff, which was wholly incorrect in putting that stuff out there as the main idea of the website, which it isn't, is ridiculous. And it's incorrect because, as I said, they've been critical of Trump. So that article was published, and that article claims that in a Zero Hedge article that they published, that they had doxed a Chinese scientist who was working at a laboratory in Wuhan, was working with bats, was working with the coronavirus. And what happened here was Zero Hedge wrote an article that cited several other articles saying, hey, you know, basically asking the question, is there a link here between this scientist and the coronavirus outbreak that has happened? And if you go back and you read Zero Hedge's original article, they don't really draw any conclusions aside from asking the question. And then at the end of the article saying, if you want further information, you may want to ask Dr. fucking Wang or whatever the guy's name is at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. He might have the answer. And then on there, they put the guy's information, which was publicly available on whatever it was, the Wuhan Institute of Virology website. So to dox somebody traditionally means to take their private information that's not out there. Like if George Gavin took my cell phone number and you pasted it all over this YouTube video, even though, you know, my number's out there somewhere, that would be doxing somebody and then encouraging people to call me on a private line that I don't have out there. That's harassment. That's doxing. But what Zero Hedge did, and I'd encourage people to read Zero Hedge's website. They have an article just called like Twitter, Zero Hedge suspended by Twitter. You can Google it. But read their response and read it very, very carefully, because what they said and what they did, in my opinion, is factually incongruent with what BuzzFeed published. If you ask my opinion, there are errors of fact in the BuzzFeed article that I don't know how they made it past not only the editor, but if they have like a board of standards or something like that at BuzzFeed as well. I'm not sure, and I would implore Zero Hedge, if they watch this, to follow through on that, because I think it's worthwhile. And then what happened after BuzzFeed wrote this article, all of a sudden, Zero Hedge, who had been on Twitter for 10 plus years and had accrued almost 700,000 followers, now no longer has a Twitter account, right? Because a pro-Trump blog doxed the scientist. Not a pro-Trump blog, and they didn't really dox him. They, you know, they took some of his public information and they put it into an article, and then in jest, said, oh, if you have any questions, ask this guy. Now, is there a reasonable basis for Zero Hedge to ask these questions, right? Obviously, I'm not Zero Hedge's fucking general counsel, so, you know, I'm just doing my best to make sense of this as a reader, somebody that read their site regularly and still doesn't read their Twitter regularly. Is there a basis for them to do this? Well, you know, the Washington Times came out the other day and said there's been several reputable sources that have been reporting on this virus that have said, we heard 4 days ago, kind of without warning and without reason or rhyme, that all of a sudden HIV drugs in China were working on curing this virus. That was a unprovoked article that came out on Yahoo Finance, I believe is where I read it, all the way back on like January 26th, before the idea of this HIV genome sequence or whatever it is being found in the virus, which has also been widely reported on in the mainstream media. So I'm not talking shit. I'm not talking out of my ass. Google HIV strand and Wuhan coronavirus and see what comes up, because the Washington Post has written about it. A couple other sites have written about it. So to see that 4 or 5 days later that all of a sudden people were making this link to this strand of the virus that is also included in HIV and, to the best of my understanding, is included in several other diseases, and then to ask a question about whether or not it may or may not be naturally occurring versus man-made, I think is a reasonable thing to do, especially when 4 or 5 days earlier we were getting these unprovoked articles that all of a sudden a cocktail of drugs, including HIV drugs, we're working on this thing. And today, I saw the same thing this morning. Gilead apparently had a cocktail of drugs that they were using that was also working on this. And I think, I believe, to the best of my understanding, to the best of what I can remember in my head here, where I have, you know, drank several thousand beers over the last decade, so I don't know how well my brain is functioning, but to the best of my recollection, they had that similar type of experience with curing it. And there were also scattered reports out of Thailand saying the same thing. So is it reasonable to ask that question? Of course, I think it's reasonable. As I wrote in an article that I wrote a couple days ago, you know, I have some experience working with Chinese nationals and a, probably a better than average understanding of how the Chinese government works. I'm certainly skeptical of everything that they say. And if you go back and you read Zero Hedge's article very closely, in my opinion, I mean, look, I don't work for the standards department at Twitter. I love Twitter. I try to be careful about what I say on Twitter. You know, I like having it as a platform and a voice, and they're their own company. They can ban whoever the fuck they want, as much as people hate it. And it's a First Amendment argument. You know, if you have a company, you can run it any way you want. I mean, that it may spur competition, but whatever. So the point of the matter is, this article I wrote the other day basically just lays out my reasoning for being skeptical about the numbers. And I think that we should be on guard about that stuff. And, you know, I watched the World Health Organization's press conference about this virus last Thursday, and it came out and it seemed like all they were doing was kissing the ass of China. They, you know, this head of the WHO came out and all he was doing was complimenting China over and over and over. They did such a good job. You know, it's been an unprecedented response. It's like, yeah, it's also been a fucking unprecedented outbreak, right? So I think only once or twice after he declared it an international public health emergency did he even say that. He spent the rest of the press conference thanking China and Xi Jinping and telling him what a fucking wonderful guy he is. Meanwhile, Xi Jinping hasn't been seen in like 4 or 5 days. The guy that's supposed to be on the front of every newspaper in China, nobody knows where the fuck he is the last 72 hours. Probably in a bunker somewhere, if you ask me. So I thought the article was very reasonable. I think it's reasonable to ask questions about this stuff. And I think that the financial community is taking a big loss in not having Zero Hedge on Twitter. And the reason I wanted to talk to you about it, and I'm very thankful that you kind of let me come on your show because you have a broader outreach than I do, is I think it's really important that people go back and read Zero Hedge's original article, read what BuzzFeed wrote in comparison to their original article, read Zero Hedge's response after the BuzzFeed article, and make up your own mind on the situation.
Yeah, I think those are all great points. From my standpoint, it's a lot more simple than that. And I tweeted out about this, and to me, it's really not about the quality or lack of quality in Zero Hedge's content. And I completely agree with what you say, that Twitter is a, although they're public, they're privately owned, they're owned by private individuals. They're not owned by the government. So they can fire whomever they want. They can hire whomever they want. They can ban whomever they want. But that doesn't mean that I have to agree with it. So my point on Twitter the other day was, yes, they have the right to do that, but I don't agree with them banning anyone. I don't care whether it's Zero Hedge. I don't care CNN, BuzzFeed. So I noticed on Twitter, a lot of people are going back and forth and saying, well, if you're going to ban Zero Hedge, you got to ban CNN because they do the exact same thing, or you got to ban BuzzFeed because they have all these sensational stories. Or
How about releasing the Steele dossier? How about BuzzFeed releasing the Christopher Steele dossier?
Yeah, I mean, you can just go down that rabbit hole all day long. Or then, you know, why not the National Enquirer or something like that? Mm-hmm. So it's to me, but that's a moot issue because it boils down to society. And at what point did we decide to value security a lot more than we value personal freedom and the freedom of choice that we have as adults? And what I mean by that is I don't need Twitter or the government or anyone else for that matter to tell me whether or not I should be reading Zero Hedge or Alex Jones or anything like that. I don't want you to tell me. Now, if that puts me in greater danger, well, then so be it. And the counter argument to that as well, we can't have Zero Hedge or anyone else out there creating all this fake news, because then people, and basically the argument, they like to dress it up in all these pretty bow ties. But the bottom line is it's everyone, that normal people are too stupid.
Right.
And smart people like me need to determine what's right and what's wrong, and what these stupid people, the average Joe, should be reading. Because if we don't monitor that, well, then the average Joe will go out and just start killing people and go crazy, and we can't have that. So the intellectual elite and the politicians, they take it upon themselves to micromanage the average Joe. And my point is, the average Joe doesn't need any type of micromanaging. They probably know more than the intellectual elite. They have more common sense, and they should be able to decide for themselves if they want to read a Zero Hedge article.
They just said, here's some shit the Wall Street Journal's reported. They cited everything. Here's some shit the Washington Post has reported. By the way, do you think there's a link? That was it.
Yeah, but my point is, I don't even know if you shouldn't be allowed to go into a movie theater and yell fire. I would consider myself pretty much an absolutist on freedom of speech. And again, it goes back to my rationale for this whole Zero Hedge thing is let me make my own decision. If I'm in a movie theater and someone comes in and yells fire, okay. I know that by not allowing that, you're protecting me, but by allowing it, you're also creating an environment, a society where I'm free to make my own decisions.
Right.
And so I would much rather live in a society where I'm fractionally more in danger because someone can come into a movie theater and yell whatever they want to.
Right.
But yet I have all this, I have a much more freedom. And see, that compounds. And as a society, if we keep going down this path where we're having to micromanage Twitter and Facebook and all these other outlets to make sure that they're not allowing someone that could say something that the intellectual elite deem as dangerous.
Right.
Well, then where does that slippery slope stop?
You keep referring to these people as the intellectual elite, which is hilarious. You know, you can make the same argument about your taxes as you're making right now about, you know, your freedom to do whatever you'd like, which is, do you think the fucking people that are collecting your taxes at the Department of Revenue at your corresponding municipality, state, and or federal government are going to be able to allocate that capital better than a private citizen is?
Right.
Probably better than some of them, but not better than all of them. And they're definitely not the cream of the crop. And trust me, you know, look, both of my parents worked for the government. Okay. My mother worked for our local library in town. She was paid by the local government. She was paid by tax dollars. My dad worked for the United States Post Office for 38, 40 years. He was a letter carrier. He was paid by the government. He was paid with tax money, or, you know, with debt that were accruing. He got paid is the point. They both worked for the government. I don't have any like deep animus aside from the fact that people that think that the people in government have some kind of superpowers and can't be challenged and can't be questioned and are the intellectual elites, as you keep referring to them, is insane. And it's the same thing whether you want to talk about allocation of your tax money or you want to talk about the government deciding what you should and should not be reading. It's fucking nonsense, okay? And look, at some point, I was lucky, maybe in my late 20s, I had a point in my life where I think we talked about on the last podcast, you know, when George W. Bush became president for the first time, and I said to my mom, this guy doesn't seem very fucking smart, okay? And my mom was like, yeah, well, you know, he really isn't. And I was like, well, don't you have to be the smartest person in the world to be the president? Because you pretty much control the free world. And she's like, no, you don't. And you're going to find out, like, the rest of the world is like that, too. So hopefully everybody has this moment where that clicks with them. We're like, all right, the people, just because they're in charge doesn't necessarily make them the smartest people in the room, right? And you can take that and trickle it down into telling you what to listen to, telling you what you can and can't say, telling you where you can and can't travel, telling you what you should be reading, telling you where your tax money is going to go, all of those things. You can make those arguments over all of them. So again, Twitter, run by private individuals, it's a corporation. Look, if they do this enough and enough people become disaffected by it, somebody may go out to the market and start their own company that seeks to solve this problem or plug this leak, right? And that's supposed to be how the free market works. If there's enough demand for it, eventually an entrepreneur will come through and create a solution for it. And nobody's saving any fucking capital, so we don't have any hope for entrepreneurship in this country right now anyways. But that's how things should work. The idea of censoring something like this, which if you ask me is so, and the other thing too is they gave two different explanations. They gave an explanation of harassment when it first happened. I saw something that said they had violated their targeted harassment policy, ostensibly talking about the doxing angle. And then I read an article like yesterday where they said that they were violating their platform abuse policy or something different. And I'm wondering if they didn't change their reasoning. But regardless, I think it's a very important discussion to have. Otherwise, where does it stop, George? Does the government have to take me fucking food shopping now? Is that what needs to happen? Am I incapable of going and picking up my own groceries? Do I need to have a government representative get in my car and drive me places? Am I incapable of this? How much does the government want to fucking micromanage our lives, right? And these people, George, they're just like me and you. They don't have superpowers. Jerome Powell doesn't have superpowers, you know? That the heads of this guy that leads the World Health Organization, this guy doesn't have superpowers. He may be a lot better versed in molecular biology than I am, but he has flaws just like everybody else in the world has flaws. And he's just as susceptible to those and his individual Achilles heels as everybody else is. But we have to come to terms with that, man. That's why I think having a discussion about things that we're being told from organizations, whether it's the government, whether it's the World Health Organization, whether it's the European Union, whether it's the, you know, whatever, American Association of Tennis Professionals. We need to be able to have open discussion and dialogue about it. It's very important because not only do people cover things up and mislead the public, it has happened in history, but also people just have good intentions but get things wrong. So it's so important to be able to have a dialogue about these things.
Yeah, I agree. Let me get your take on something. I did a video this morning, and I had this in there as just kind of a thought. And I know that Dr. Chris Martinson, if you've watched any of his stuff on the coronavirus, has been very critical of the World Health Organization and the mainstream media. But one thing that I heard him say, which was very interesting, is that before the World Health Organization comes out and makes a big public announcement, they always do a cost-benefit analysis. So they say, all right, if we come out and say that this pandemic is as bad as we think, well, how much damage is that going to do from an economic standpoint? And then they juxtapose that to how many lives they think it may save. Okay, I get that.
Yeah, they're like they're an insurance company, right?
Yeah, but if you take that a step further, and then you think about the fact that we're in an everything bubble, so stocks are in a bubble, bonds are in a bubble, corporate debt markets in a bubble. We have all these huge bubbles that if they burst or when they burst, there's going to be much more pain than if we weren't in those bubbles. So would that weigh on the World Health Organization, meaning would there have to be more deaths or a potential of more deaths to get them to tell the truth because the Fed has pumped up all of these bubbles? Yeah. So you could almost say that the Fed is making us, is creating a health risk in the sense that the powers that be won't be honest with us, because if they were, it would create more damage to the economy than if the stock market was at 15,000.
You're 100% right. You're 100% right. And the certainty is that there's going to be an existential threat that we can't print our way out of, and we can't act like everything is fine our way out of. Okay. So we've been doing that with the financial markets for a decade, two decades, longer than that, right? We can just print money. I mean, these assholes think that they're going to be able to print their way out of a pandemic problem, you know, as if there's a certain amount of dollars that can roll off of a printing press somewhere that is biologically going to stop a virus from entering a human being's body. It's insane. People in China are talking about, people on CNBC on Friday, Wilfred Frost was on CNBC. You know, the Dow was down 630, 640 at the end of the day. And he's going, oh, we're going to start to see some stimulus coming out of China now. You know, it's like, brother, that's not the fucking problem. The problem is the virus. Fuck the money printing. We need to figure out what the details of this virus are. We got to figure out whether this is going to become a pandemic. Otherwise, you know, then you're going to have an epidemic and you're going to have hyperinflation, which is like a 1-2 punch in the nuts instead of just one punch in the nuts. I think you make a perfect point. We have gotten so far off track and we have gotten so far removed from what a normal market should be, a normal rate of interest should be, you know, that obviously the downfall is going to be significant. It's going to be unexpected. We're going to see capitulation and we're going to see some austerity in a way that we haven't seen it before, which is what I love when people make fun of me because I'm a gold-toting, gun-toting, you know, whiskey cabinet full type individual with extra locks on the doors and extra ammunition because people don't realize. I mean, 2008 will be a cakewalk. People were fucking pissed in 2008. I mean, there was the whole Occupy Wall Street movement. There were real protests. There were people that got hurt. It was a big deal. The next one is going to be much worse. The wealth gap has expanded between the fucking haves and the have-nots. You know, the CPI is covering up the actual rate of inflation that we're seeing now. Even the CPI is going to be ugly if we have to print a significant amount of money the way that people are talking about it. The rich will get richer. The poor will, you know, that wealth gap will continue to expand. And it's going to be an unfortunate wake-up call for a lot of people. And the thing, George, is Ron Paul said to me, I just did a podcast with Ron Paul a couple of days ago on my podcast. And so he said to me something that he had said to me in the past, which was, if you want to have a competition between markets and the Fed, the markets are eventually going to win. The free market's eventually going to win. At some point, it's going to reach a tipping point. And that's the same thing with these existential crises, like this pandemic. Put aside where this fucking thing came from, who's responsible for it, whether or not we got ahead of it, which I don't think we did. I think it could be a bigger problem than people think. Put that all aside. There remains existential threats, black swans, whatever you want to call them, that are going to force people to take the medicine. And the super stupendous people in government with their very big brains, as our fucking president says, are not going to have the solution. And people just need to allow 1% of that ideology to get into their head. And I think we'd all be a lot better off.
Yeah. So let me unpack that a little bit. So first, I want to get your thoughts on the market being up today. That was shocking. And I think that what just me being a layman, I look at that and I say, okay, well, that must be because China committed so much stimulus. So the US market is looking at that saying, okay, well, that's next coming. You know, if by chance the coronavirus gets to the United States, hopefully it won't, obviously, but if it does to where the US has to, you know, shut down flights or potentially cities or anything to the extent that they've done
in China. They've already shut down flights.
Right. But I'm talking about domestic flights and whatnot.
Okay.
But, you know, then the market is probably saying, okay, well, Powell's going to come out and print money like there is no, like nothing we have ever seen before.
Correct.
So do you think the fact that the market is up today signals the fact that the market is trying to front run more what they see as eventual or inevitable money printing, or what do you think?
It could be. I mean, it's certainly not pricing in the risk of a global pandemic, I'll tell you that. I think people are used to buying dips. I think we've been conditioned over the last 10, 15 years to go in and buy anytime that there's significant selling, regardless. When the China A-share market crashed in like 2015 or 2016, when they had their crash, when Trump was elected and the futures got shellacked, when Brexit happened and the market crashed, all those times the market was bid back up. Was it bid up by market participants or was it bid up by, you know, the Fed? Who the fuck knows? You know, I don't even want to speculate about that. But people have been conditioned with the help of our happy, jolly mainstream CNBC media, who are more than happy to go on television every day and give you a tray full of excuses as to why you should be buying stocks. Every day they parade another asset manager on there who's going to tell you that whatever the problem is now, it will pass. You know, people are going out and comparing this to Ebola. It's like, okay, but it's not fucking Ebola, right? So maybe there needs to be some nuance. Some guy came out and said, every time we've seen one of these outbreaks, the market has been bid back up. It's like, yeah, that's the truth. And if all of these things were the same and history always repeated itself, that would be a really nice argument to make. But at some point, things are going to deviate from what we've seen before, and we're going to be presented with something that we don't have the answer to, and the market is not going to like that, regardless of how much money Powell is printing. Am I surprised the market is up today? No, I almost think it's like a sad joke that the market is up today. Price discovery, all right? We have Tesla trading at $135 billion valuation today. The company has never had a profitable year. It's incinerating hundreds of millions of dollars in cash. It's a car company that's being valued at a forward price-to-earnings ratio of 50 when its peers are being valued at 6 to 7 times earnings. Its CEO has come out and made numerous false statements and has been sued by the Securities and Exchange Commission for making misleading statements, and they allege securities fraud. Okay, that company is at $135 billion valuation. The Dow Jones is up 200 points right now on news of what? That this pandemic is continuing. Now there's 17,000 people affected and 360 deaths.
Yeah, correct me if I'm wrong, Chris, but isn't a bit the narrative for Tesla's growth strategy, isn't it China?
That's a huge part of it.
So if China is on lockdown and they're shutting down all the Starbucks and all the Apples, shouldn't that somehow translate into Tesla's share price going down just a little bit, or maybe not?
I made a joke last night on Twitter, which I was really only like half joking about, but I was watching. I think another reason that the markets were up today is because the China A share market had been closed since like January 28th. And so people were widely expecting a 5 to 10% drop in the market when it reopened, basically to play catch up to the U.S. markets. So the fact that it wasn't a worse bloodbath, I think, is kind of what gave some of these idiots, you know, the impetus to go out and say, oh, maybe we should buy today. Oh, it's only down 8%, right? Okay, right. That was with them injecting a ton of liquidity into the market.
$134 billion.
And with a ban on short selling and with a ban on selling large positions, and the market was still down 8%. And my guess is it's going to get assholed again tonight. I think probably what will happen is it'll open up 1%, 2%, and it'll get plowed. And I think we should watch the Chinese markets because the people in China are way better in the know about how bad this problem is right now than we are in the United States. So if we see some real capitulation and they mow through all the stops that the government has put through in China, that could be a serious indicator that things are worse than we think that they are, right? Another thing I would be watching is the fatality rate outside of China. If you don't trust China's data, take the international data. And yes, I know a lot of this is subject to how well the healthcare systems work in various countries, but aggregate the data of how many people have been infected with this virus outside of China and how many deaths we've seen outside of China, because there are rumors and speculations and some articles. Hey, look, the New York Times is out now calling this a pandemic and being critical of China's response time on this. There's people that have come out and said people are dying from this, but they're being put down as, you know, pneumonia instead of coronavirus or whatever, you know, or people that have been infected, they're citing other causes of death. So let's look at the data that comes out of China and see if it aligns with the data in China. As far as today's market, who the fuck knows, George? We're so far off the path right now. Our market is so far, we are so far deviated from normal. Who knows? I mean, who knows why the market's up? Who knows if, you know, the Fed's in there buying the spoos, which is something I've speculated. I wouldn't be surprised if it happened. I'm not saying that they're doing it. I'm just saying I think they will eventually do it if they're not doing it. But I don't know. I'm frightened because printing isn't the answer and inflation is going to happen if we do that. And there's always an existential consequence to the actions that we've been taking, that anytime you try to manipulate a free market, whether it's by manipulating interest rates or printing money or ignoring a virus that's clearly happening and spreading, anytime you try to do that, there becomes a point where an existential threat can usurp all of this man-made nonsense and bullshit that we've been telling ourselves that we're doing to keep everything fine and dandy. We actually, our government and our Fed, they actually think they're in control. They think they're in control. Is that insane?
Yeah, so unfortunately, so do a lot of people in the market and everyone on CNBC. But so what you're saying, I think, is very important. And that is that although the Fed's QE or money printing, expanding the balance sheet, has created a boom in stocks as far back as we can remember with our, you know, human recency bias, at some point in time, the market is going to say, listen, you're printing all this money and we don't care because our downside is so great that we just don't care if you expand the balance sheet by another $4 trillion, another $10 trillion. We're not buying stocks, no matter how bad you want us to. And,
right.
Or the same thing with treasuries.
There's a psychology break there that is also an existential threat. So the joke I made last night was if the China markets were to go green on the news of this epidemic, while everybody's sitting around in China on lockdown, locked in their house, looking at what appears to be some type of dystopian zombie apocalypse in that country. I mean, that's really what it fucking looks like, right?
Yeah.
50-something million people quarantined, over 15 major cities locked down. If people are sitting at home looking out their window and they see that, and then they turn on the internet and they see that the Chinese stock market is up, at some point, couldn't that cause a confidence break for people that don't even understand how the Fed works to say, something's fucking wrong here. You don't need to be a market expert to understand that. You can be a plumber and understand that. You know, like the stock market should be down. Something really bad is happening. And it's going to be something like that that's going to trigger people to have a real psychological break and a confidence break in the central banks. That is going to cause some much overdue panic and some real capitulation. That's when you're going to see gold, you know, hit $5,000, $10,000 an ounce. Like that. Ron Paul just said on my podcast, there's always a reason for gold to go up $100. I mean, if I woke up tomorrow and gold was at $3,000 an ounce, would I be surprised? No, I would be like, it's about fucking time. So
yeah. Yeah.
Then people ask why you own gold, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think your point is so great in the sense that we've got to realize as just onlookers that the stock market is totally removed from the real economy. I mean, and it's weird because as we've grown up and everyone, just the average Joe out there on the street thinks that there's a direct correlation. So whatever the stock market is doing, the economy must be doing the same thing.
Right.
They must be working in lockstep, right? Because the stock market is just a reflection of those companies that are in the real economy. And that's why Trump leverages that so much. But we have to start understanding that they are completely detached. The market exclusively revolves now around liquidity.
Right.
It has nothing to do with the fundamentals of the economy or any economy for that matter.
Right.
And people have to ask themselves, if they have money in the market, am I willing to take that risk that if I'm buying Apple or if I'm buying Tesla or whatever, I'm not buying the fundamentals. I'm not buying a future stream of cash flow. I'm betting that the Federal Reserve is just going to print more money.
Exactly. And that's going to work.
Yeah, right.
So if you're in China now and you need to understand that correlation does not equal causation or whatever the point is you're trying to make about the economy and the stock market not being one and the same, look out your fucking window at 1:30 p.m. on a Tuesday afternoon. There's nobody in the street. There's nobody buying things. There's nobody riding the subway. And then turn around and look how one of the world's largest economies in China grinding to a halt and doing nothing is affecting the U.S. stock market, which is up 75 basis points today.
Yeah. And I think another thing that people need to understand, because a lot of Americans see this as just kind of a China-centric issue. And while we shouldn't worry, it's just China. That is unfortunate for them from a humanitarian standpoint. But from an economic standpoint, it really doesn't affect us. And you just made the point that China is the second largest economy in the entire world. And if they go into lockdown mode, whether the Americans like it or not, that is going to affect the United States tremendously, not only from an export standpoint with the shale industry, but just look at the imports. Where are we going to get those imports? And where is the demand going to be for those dollars that China was stuffing under their mattress and all of these excess green pieces of paper that were going over there, or the treasuries they're buying? You know, another thing, too, a lot of people think that you know, it's not a big deal if there's less demand for treasuries from China because they've been a net seller over the past couple of years or so. But they don't understand that China's not holding on to $1 trillion in 30-year debt. So my point is they've got to roll that over.
Right.
So people get fixated on the net selling side, but they forget about the buying side.
Right.
And what if they just decide to not buy anymore? And what if they don't have a choice? What if their economy is doing so poorly that you know, when they go to roll that over, they say, you know what, instead of those treasuries, sorry guys, we're not going to buy more. We need the dollars to go into the FX market to get more currency to pay for whatever debt, whatever's going on in their economy. Then all of a sudden, you've got the same situation as if China were just to sell all the $1 trillion that they have in U.S. debt. What does that do to the dollar? My point is there's a lot of systemic risk, even if that health hazard doesn't come to the United States or anywhere else in the world.
And the whole thing, the whole house of cards that you're describing, rests on the idea and the confidence in the idea that the way that central banks around the world have rigged the system will always have the solution. The whole thing rests on the confidence that being able to print is always going to work. And being able to create liquidity out of thin air is always going to work. And that somehow over the last 40 years, we have, which we've never done before in history, in the last 40 years, we have stumbled upon the grand solution to the global economy. Knowing what you know about the human race, is that a bet you want to take? I mean, for me, it's a resounding fuck no. I can't speak for your listeners and I can't speak for you, but I mean, that's it. It all relies on confidence that we have found the solution. And George, we both know that we haven't. We're too dumb. The human race is too fucking stupid. We really are.
Yeah. Another thing that's bizarre to me is that people look back and think that quantitative easing or printing money always solves the problem. But then and these are the same people that you say, well, interest rates can go up here if we print more money. And they say, no, I don't think so. Look at Japan. But then when you say, okay, look at the Japanese stock market, it's never got back to where it was in 1990. They ignore that. Like we can be Japan with interest rates, but we can't be Japan with the stock market. I don't know how they connect those dots.
Well, they're not connecting the dots. That's the problem.
Yeah. All right, Chris, I know that you're on a hard deadline. I really appreciate your time and all of your insights. For those people who want to find out more about you or download your podcast, which I would highly suggest, where can they go to do that?
It's Quote the Raven podcast. You can just Google it. You can find me if you want. You can put the stuff in the podcast in the description below, and people can go down and click it. Don't follow me on Twitter, though. I'm trying to diversify my social media following now in case I get banned too. So just search for Chris Irons, Quote the Raven. That's it. Ignore anything that you see that is negative about me and embrace only the positive. That's what I
All right, buddy. Let's
George,
do it again soon, man.
Congratulations on the success of your channel, man. It's really awesome. And I think that your viewers they really get it. And I would encourage them to turn around and instead of going to my shit, find like one or two other people to introduce your channel to, because the rate at which it's growing is like exponential. And I think it's so healthy. And I think you're so exceptionally brilliant. I've watched some videos on your channel. I think your perspective is so badly needed. So thank you very much, George.
I appreciate it, Chris. Let's do it again soon, buddy.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.